What should we do first? Talk to the Secretary of Commerce or do our weekly wrap? Secretary of Commerce, weekly wrap. What do you think? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Risnall. Friday, the 15th of April. Great to have you with us, everybody. Also with us, at least metaphorically speaking, Lynette Lopez. She is with Business Insider. Sudeep Reddy is with The Wall Street Journal. The topic, as it usually is 2 minutes into this program on a Friday afternoon, is what the heck has been happening since Monday. Hey, everybody.
Hey.
Hey. Hey. All right. So you guys won over the Secretary of Commerce, first of all. Surprise. Sudeep, Sudeep, I want to start with you, and I want to talk about this week in large financial institutions, this idea that five of the big banks this week were found not to have met their living will requirements, that is, the ability to be taken apart if the economy goes south and they get stressed. How worried are you about that?
Well, this is a long process. They've been fighting this for years of what should a living will be? What does it even mean to have a living will? And whether the firms have done what's necessary to protect themselves so that we're not on the hook as taxpayers. Now, the notion that a major financial institution could fail today or a year from now and not cost taxpayers any money still seems like utter fantasy. Like, it doesn't really fit with how we think about it. But the worst part of this is we'll never really know until a crisis hits whether it would work. And in a crisis, we're likely to say, well, but it was a perfect storm. So that's what took it down and is not the actual details of what these firms did.
Lynette, what was the vibe on Wall Street, actually? I mean, what were the banks saying? What were you hearing at the bars and you know, the clubs of New York?
And the club that I was in was a very fancy schmancy investor conference.
And
actually, Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan, happened to be speaking there the day that it was found that his bank did not have an adequate living will. And basically what he had to say was, you know, hey, this is a work in progress. We're all getting killed across the street. We have to hold more money than we ever have before instead of putting it to work to make more money. And that's hurting our business. But, you know, this is what we have to deal with in order to make the economy safe. And that's just part of what we do now. Some of the hedge fund managers in the audience were bellyaching a little bit more than Jamie actually was.
Interesting. All right. New topic, Sudeep. China, its numbers out today. Growth there is slowing, slowest in 7 years. I want you to relate that to the American consumer, who seems to be the bright spot in the global economy. Discuss.
The bright spot in the global economy means that we have American consumers who still want to buy cheap stuff as much as possible. And we are buying the cheap stuff that China produces. Yeah. And it's helping China maintain its existing model. And what China is doing, obviously, China's growth numbers are generously estimated.
Yeah,
they come up with a lot of numbers in a somewhat quirky and unusual fashion that we wouldn't necessarily accept here. But when you go in the direction they're going, they're trying to do a much longer term change in their economy, and nobody in the political leadership really wants to force it that way. So they go through and pour more stimulus money in, do whatever is necessary, and it's just maintaining the existing order of Americans buying a lot of stuff, Chinese still producing it, and we're still quite far away from actually turning that order around. Buying things?
The problem is that China has too much stuff and the rest of the world doesn't want it. Americans are still buying that cheap stuff, but China just has way too much of it. And instead of getting rid of the companies that make this stuff that the world doesn't want, China's just pumping more money into them because they don't want to see their GDP go down. They don't want to see people out of work, even though they're already planning that that's going to happen. And they don't want to have to take care of these painful reforms.
Right.
But they have so much stuff. So much stuff.
That's a technical
economic business. I mean, all kinds of trinkets, mad steel, coal. Nobody wants it. And that's the biggest problem.
Last thing, Lynette, and then we'll let you go because we've got 40 seconds left. I know you follow this. You tweet about it all the time. I want you to give us the 30-second elevator pitch on what is going on down in Brazil. The president there, Dilma Rousseff, is facing impeachment this weekend. This is a big deal.
we're seeing the end of the ruling Brazilian ruling party for like the last 15 years, the PT. And they were found to be caught in the heads of a essentially corruption scandal that involved basically looting the state oil company Petrobras 2 years ago. Dilma herself has not been she's not been accused of any wrongdoing, but she is going through impeachment proceedings right now because they're accusing her of lying about the health of the economy last year when things were going south. I mean, we're talking double-digit inflation, right, while her approval number is in the single digits. You know, economic growth is nil, and the commodities that Brazil exports to the rest of the world, nobody wants them. Right. Same problem as China.
Same problem
nobody
as China. And the Olympics are coming, and it's going to be a long, hot summer down there.
It's a hot mess.
Lynette Lopez at Business Insider, Sadiq Reddy at The Wall Street Journal. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Guy.
All right,
thanks,
have
Guy.
A good weekend. On Wall Street today, a little bit more down than up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Obama administration did something interesting today. It said on the record in the form of a presidential executive order that it wants more competition in the private sector in this economy. And government agencies have 60 days to figure out how they are going to do that. The Federal Communications Commission is first up. The White House wants the FCC to figure out ways to open up television set-top boxes to competition, about which more in just a second. First, though, the Secretary of Commerce, Penny Pritzker, on competition in this economy and where the U.S. is in the global economy. She is here with us at the corner of 2nd and Figueroa in downtown L.A. Madam Secretary, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
Thank you for coming to the studio. It's a treat to have you in the building.
Happy to be here in L.A.
I want to start with this executive order from the president today about the federal government doing what it can to increase competition in the private sector. Mm-hmm. I can hear the howls from conservative economists and business owners and leaders in this country saying, are you kidding me? You want to improve competition in the private economy? Get government out of the way. Don't give me more rules. Mm-hmm. What do you say?
Well, I think that that's true in some instances. And obviously, the president's been very focused on trying to roll back regulations in certain areas. But in, as it relates to set-top boxes, you know, one of the challenges has been for 20 years, Congress has said we need to have more competition in the set-top mm-hmm. box. And now yeah. that the technology is caught up to a point where we have content coming at us on the internet, we have content coming at us on our phones, et cetera, why shouldn't we be able in our homes to have more flexibility? And that's really fundamentally one of the issues the president's focused on.
Which I get, but you understand the irony here of the government sort of regulating competition. You will have competition.
I think really what the government is trying to say is, how do we create the conditions where there's more competition?
All right. I want to run something by you that I spoke with your colleague, Treasury Secretary Liu, about on Monday. We had a good chat. We went half an hour, he and I did. Unfortunately, we had to leave the questions on the Trans-Pacific Partnership on the cutting room floor for time, because this is only a half-hour broadcast. But I do want to get back to it with you and circle around to the question of this. Congress has said it's not going to touch that thing until a lame duck, if at all. You are now tasked in a trade-heavy political season with selling this thing both to the Congress mm-hmm. and the American people. I wonder whether you think you're losing the battle there.
Let's step back for a minute and talk about trade in a larger context, which is the strength of a country is often measured by the strength of its economy. And one of the things that we're trying to do in this administration is give our economy as much a chance as possible to grow. Mm-hmm. And 95% of customers are outside the United States. 80% of purchasing power is outside the United States. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is an agreement that addresses the fastest growing marketplace in the world, the Asia-Pacific mm-hmm. region. This is a marketplace where our companies do not have equal access today. And what we know is that American businesses that export create jobs that pay more for Americans here in the United States. So this is about creating opportunity, making sure that the international labor standards are applied countries.
Why then, by and large, is American labor so opposed to this deal?
I think it's a knee-jerk reaction. And I think that there is, you know, any kind of shift has repercussions. One of the things that we've been very focused on as we talk about trade, as we talk about globalization, as we talk about the implications for technology on the workforce, is that we have to also invest in workforce training and to make sure that those folks, as markets change, have the opportunity to be reskilled or upskilled to meet the jobs that are, as our economies are changing. But that's going to happen with or without trade agreements. So we need to focus on that.
What happens if this thing does not pass? Then what do you do?
Well, it's a terrible loss for America, because the other part, and if you read, you know, Secretary Kerry gave a very important speech this week about the national security implications of TPP. You know, this right now, what we've negotiated and the deal that we've got is one where America is leading in the Asia-Pacific region. Without this, our leadership is diminished, and that's a problem as you have a rising China, as you have extraordinary trade going on in the fastest growing marketplace in the world.
What's your biggest worry about the American economy in a global environment today?
My biggest worry is access. Countries are, you know, working through various means to reduce access by American companies to their marketplaces. And that's why TPP is so important. That's why TTIP is so important.
That's the European trade deal.
Exactly. And it's why the we're constantly working at the Department of Commerce to try and help American companies be able to sell their goods around the world.
Let me make sure I understood you there. You think countries are trying to deny American corporations and firms access to their markets?
I think that they put up trade barriers that make it very difficult at times for American companies.
Penny Pritzker is the Secretary of Commerce. Thanks, ma'am, very much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
All right, so back to set-top boxes, about which the Secretary spoke just a bit. Televisions themselves have, of course, changed drastically in the past couple of decades. The boxes through which millions of Americans still get their signal and for which they pay a monthly fee haven't changed all that much at all. They will, though, if the Obama administration has its way. Nova Sappho has more.
Order a cable or satellite plan, and you have to have one of those mysterious set-top boxes that turn signals zipping through wires into images on TV screens.
Most set-top boxes are generally the same they were 10 or 15 years ago.
Michael Paxton, a pay TV analyst at SNL Kagan, says those boxes cost us a lot, and they cost pay TV companies a lot, too.
They're making large upfront investments to pay for the boxes. A consumer paying $5, $10, $12 a month in many cases doesn't cover the cost.
At least not for a couple of years or so. Still, cable and satellite providers want control of set-top boxes to prevent people from stealing signals. Harvard's Susan Crawford has studied the telecom industry.
It hasn't been easy for manufacturers to manufacture boxes that aren't approved by the cable industry itself. So that's a problem.
The FCC wants to fix that problem with a proposal allowing anyone to make and sell set-top boxes. Today, the Obama administration said it supports that plan. Industry consultant John Lauterbach says if the plan's approved, you might be able to use your TV subscription with some pretty familiar tech names.
You could plug it into your PlayStation or your Xbox, Roku or a Fire TV or some other smart video processing box, and then take advantage of some of the capabilities of those systems.
President Obama doesn't want to stop at pay TV. His executive order directs agencies to find other industries that might need more competition. Among the possibilities, banking, farm machinery, and the dairy industry. In Chicago, I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
Coming up,
it's not a sustainable thing. I mean, we're the digital economy, e-commerce, is really accelerating this.
We all want same-day delivery, but it is killing the transportation system. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gave up 28 points today, about a 10%, ended at 17,897. The NASDAQ slipped 7 points lower, 0.1%, 49.38. The S&P 500 off 2 points, also a 10%. 2080. For the week, the Dow and the NASDAQ both gained about 1.8%. The S&P 500 up 1.6%. Today, Papa Murphy's Holdings, it operates the Take and Bake pizza chain, heated up 5.7%. Shoe Carnival, a Midwestern chain with 400 stores, tied on 2 2/10% today. Miller Industries, It makes equipment for tow trucks, cranked up nearly 2%. Culp Incorporated, a producer of mattress fabrics, puffed up 4%. I learn something every day about the American economy when I do this segment. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. There's a meeting Sunday over in Doha, Qatar, in the Persian Gulf, that the oil world has been waiting for a good couple of months now. Some of the biggest OPEC producers, and Russia as well, are expected to formally agree to freeze production. That is, control supply in an oversupplied world and thus bump crude prices up a little bit, or so the hope goes. And that is what it is. But the thing is that global oil glut that we've been talking about for more than a year now, it might already be going away all on its own. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong has that story.
Say you own a donut shop, OPEC Donuts. You flip your machine to high and you cannot make donuts any faster. And then you promise to freeze production at that super high level. To many, that's kind of what the oil producers plan to do Sunday in Doha. Neil Atkinson is with the International Energy Agency in Paris.
Nobody seriously believes that amongst the ranks of most of the countries attending the talks, they have any ability to significantly increase their production in any event. It's just essentially the status quo.
There is one wild card, Iran, which could undercut a deal. But the broader market reality is that overall world supply beyond OPEC is already falling.
We are slowly moving from a supply glut to a balance.
That's Jim Burkhardt of IHS Energy in Oman. He says the big supplier to cut back because of low prices is the U.S.
U.S. production is down about 500,000 barrels per day from last April. That's the biggest driver in this rebalancing that is underway.
Pair that with hearty demand growth in the world, and in a year, that oversupply could be gone. So, if the market is doing its job, why are producers meeting? For the audience back home, says Omar Al-Baidli of the Bahrain Center for Strategic International and Energy Studies. He spoke by cell phone.
The citizens are wondering, there must be something you can do. So just like when you get a crisis in any country, it's not acceptable for the government to look like it's doing nothing. So they have to at least look like they're doing something.
And he says it's important to keep the market up. Oil prices have risen for 3 months now, from under $30 a barrel to more than $40. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The economic theme of the week this week has kind of been that the financial crisis is still with us. All the conversations about too big to fail and living wills and all of that. Well, the Federal Housing Finance Agency, for one, is really trying to put 2008 in the rearview mirror in what the FHFA calls a final crisis-era modification program. It's going to offer principal reduction, a reduction in the amount actually owed to 33,000 homeowners who are underwater on their houses. 33,000 of them, which doesn't seem like a whole lot, as Marketplace's Sabri Benishour explains.
There are places in this country where the housing crisis still lingers, where home prices haven't recovered, and foreclosures are still a problem. And that's what this program is for.
To help clean up the remnants of the crisis.
That's Chris Mayer, professor at Columbia. So the FHFA wants to help bring interest rates down to market levels and reduce the amount people owe on their homes, specifically people who got loans through Freddie or Fannie and who are seriously underwater and behind.
And the goal is to convert people who are severely underwater to moderately underwater.
In all, this would help up to 33,000 homeowners. And if that sounds like a small number, that's because it is. Mike Calhoun is president of the Center for Responsible Lending.
There are 6 million homeowners who are underwater.
But here's the thing. Most of those people are making payments on time. Jim Parrott is a senior fellow at the Urban Institute.
Because the economy has improved over the last several years, the number of delinquent borrowers has fallen off dramatically.
Which raises the question, where was this program 5 or 6 years ago when more people could have benefited? It was actually a very contentious question at the time.
The risk that in providing this sort of benefit, you would incentivize borrowers who could otherwise pay to go delinquent on their loan in order to receive the benefit.
Ironically, this kind of program is exactly what a lot of banks were already doing. So Freddie and Fannie are playing catch up.
It's a tool that is very useful to have pulled out of the toolbox, finally, and hopefully it will remain out of the toolbox.
For the next crisis. Otherwise put, he says, better late than never. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Yeah. It's all kinds of easy for people to go about their daily lives without giving too much thought to how we got here. Literally, how we got here. The transportation footprint that goes into the food we eat, the phones we carry, the clothes we wear, everything. Edward Humes writes about all the to-ing and fro-ing that has to happen to make our economy work the way we have become accustomed to. In his new book, it's called Door to Door, The Magnificent, Maddening, Mysterious World of Transportation. It's good to have you on.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So we were talking out in the lobby before we came to the studio about the book and honestly how much I enjoyed it, but also how depressing it is, because you cannot turn around in this economy without leaving a huge transportation footprint.
It's true, and it's not always as obvious as you might think. There's so much transportation, so many miles embedded in our daily lives.
You start with your cup of coffee in the morning, but pick another one for me, just because, you know, the coffee's the easy one.
The gas in my tank. You know, when you fill up your gas tank, if you live in California, as I do, it's a petroleum cocktail that travels 100,000 miles. To get to your tank via tanker ship, via truck, via pipeline, and via rail. And that's before you drive a mile with it.
Before you carry it around with you to drive some more. There's a great quote in this book. You say that our transportation system, and I guess that's kind of a misnomer, right? Because it's not one transportation, but transportation as we know it on the globe today, all the systems put together, is a thing of wonder and madness.
It is. In a sense, it may be humanity's greatest achievement. I mean, the capacity to move a supercomputer or a tube of toothpaste or you name it from a factory in China or somewhere in Asia.
Yeah.
And to have that material appear in one of our ports and then make it to our homes and to do this hundreds of millions of times a day, reliably, trackably, with minimal loss is a feat that would appear to be either magic or miraculous to all but those generations now alive.
Is that, though, and here it is, value judgment time, is that a good thing that we've been able to do that?
It's not a sustainable thing. I mean, and the digital economy, e-commerce, is really accelerating this. You know, I was talking to the head of UPS headquarters in Los Angeles, busiest region for the company in the world. And now we've gone from delivering a whole truckload of goods to one location, you know, a shopping center, a store, departments, or whatever, to a model where they're delivering the same amount of goods to 120 different locations per truck. And those are all those extra trips. That's orders of magnitudes more trips and bigger boxes to ship because, you know, if you ever shopped online, you know that a little thing comes in a big box.
Is there a way in the bigger picture, though, that we can have all that we want in this economy without that transportation footprint?
Our transportation sector is the most inefficient part of our economy, you know, and it's a paradox because manufacturers will tell you, oh, transportation is the least part of our footprint. But if you look at how we use and waste energy in America, you know, energy we burn but don't actually do anything useful with, it's almost 80% of the energy that we put into our cars and trucks and trains and planes is wasted. I see actually some hopeful trends, though, if you will.
Go ahead, please. Because honestly, as I said at the beginning, this book is awesome, but it's so depressing.
Well, I worry about that. But there's a couple things on the horizon. One is the technology of 3D printing, which is incredibly promising and still in its infancy, but already doing incredible things. You know, people are printing prosthetic limbs.
Right.
It's almost like the Star Trek transporter technology. Imagine an online retailer isn't selling you a physical product, but is selling you the software to build that product.
Do it yourself.
Yeah. And maybe not in your home, maybe at a local sort of 3D printing shop. That would be the ultimate disruptor.
A book by Edward Humes is called Door to Door. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
The news final note on the way out today, which conveniently comes just days after the 2015-16 National Basketball Association season went out in a double blaze of Steph Curry, Kobe Bryant glory. NBA owners voted today to allow ads on players' jerseys starting in 2 years, 2017. It's not much. Just a 2.5-inch by 2.5-inch space on the uniform will be sold for ads. Commissioner Adam Silver says it should bring in about $100 million a year, split 50-50 with the players. Still, no. It's Friday, quitting time. Gotta go. The Dow gave up 28 points today, about a 10%. The NASDAQ down 7 points, about a 10% there as well. The S&P 500 off 2 points, also a 10%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdal. I'll see you Monday. Everybody, have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.